Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is New Albany DVD against the City of New Albany. Mr. Burkle.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Berchtel and I represent the appellant, the City of New Albany. We request this court to reverse the preliminary injunction entered by the trial court for the reasons set forth in our brief. Today I will address 2 points in support of our position. We believe the injunction should be reversed because each of the separate grounds on which it rests is legally erroneous. First, the district court erred as a matter of law when it held that the city's buffer between sexually oriented businesses and sensitive land uses is not narrowly tailored because the court envisioned less restrictive alternatives that would allegedly serve the government interest.
Before you start into your argument, please, would you be so kind as to tell me whether the record reflects as to whether an ILP was issued and as to whether the zoning department ever processed a request for an ILP by DVD?
Yes, Your Honor. The record does reflect that an ILP was never requested by DVD until 2 months after the ordinance was passed. And then after that, it was rejected in part for reasons based upon the ordinance. The district court found at page 29 of the appendix that, in fact, prior to their illegal opening, they had never applied for an ILP from the zoning office under 156.141. Does that answer your question?
Telling me what an ILP is, for those of us who are not steeped in the acronyms used in New Albany, using English would be a big help.
I apologize, Your Honor. ILP stands for Improvement Location Permit. It's a
That's pretty much gibberish, too.
I do agree that the terminology it's set forth in the Indiana state statutes is not particularly helpful, but it is a state statutory requirement in conjunction with local ordinances, which flesh out the requirement in more detail. In this case, it requires that when a change in use of the prior property is made, that you have to submit a site plan, a parking plan, a site development, a showing of ingress and egress for public health and safety purposes. And that's the second reason that we believe that the district court should be reversed, because it committed legal error when it concluded that DVD was entitled to the protection of the amortization period as a lawful pre-existing non-conforming use, notwithstanding the fact that it had not applied for an improvement location permit. On the narrow tailoring issue...
Yeah, let's explore that a little. What cases in Indiana deal with somebody who applies for and gets a building permit, builds out the site under the building permit, and then is confronted with a zoning change before an ILP or some equivalent is sought?
I think the Steuben County Waste Watchers case deals with that issue because it involved a use that had a special exception that was granted for the use, but later on they wanted to add some tanks, and the court said...
Which case is this?
That's the Steuben County Waste Watchers case versus Family Development, I believe.
There was cited a building permit issued in that case?
There was a special use exception, which is somewhat like a zoning permit issued in that case.
I didn't ask about a zoning permit. I asked about a building permit.
Your Honor, there are a couple of cases cited in our brief that deal with the building permit issue. I believe one of them was even cited in Appellee's brief, allegedly in support, and that's the Fort Wayne versus Shell Oil case. And basically, the argument was because we applied for a building permit, which is a remodeling permit, basically, to alter the interior configuration of the premises, that grandfathered them as to the improvement location permit that was filed 6 months later.
And no one is arguing that anybody is being grandfathered with respect to some other permit. The argument, as I understand it, is that the use is grandfathered. Now, what I've been looking for, what I have found, is a case in which a building permit is issued, the building is constructed or renovated in accordance with the building permit, and then the city changes the zoning law, making it impossible to get an occupancy permit. How do Indiana courts treat that sequence? That's what I'm looking for.
I, again, Your Honor, don't know if there's a specific case on point with that sequence. At least I do not believe that I discovered one in my research. However, I will say that the case law does make it clear that the permit process is limited to specific permits of specific projects for based on set forth in specific proposals. What the specific proposal set forth in their December 29 building permit, which is what the district court found that it was after weighing all the testimony, was simply a remodeling building permit, was simply to alter the interior of a building. And as explained in by our witnesses in the trial court, that this is a dual purpose form. Depending on what the applicant submits to the government as far as the nature of the project, that will determine what requirements apply. In this case, the applicant specifically omitted that they were altering the use of the property from that of the prior tenant, and therefore the building department did not send it to the zoning people because there was no change of use indicated on the form. Instead, they just looked at whether the structural modifications to the interior...
Was this a change of use that was relevant under the old zoning code?
The change of use was the most critical fact in the case, Your Honor, on this issue.
From one kind of retail establishment to another retail establishment.
It was not, Your Honor.
Was that relevant under the old zoning code? I thought it was just given that this was a proper use under the old zoning code before New Albany changed its law.
Your Honor, what was allowable were various types of general commercial uses in the C2 zone, but that is not the particular question. The question at issue is whether they apply for an improvement location permit.
That's what you say the question is. What they say the question is whether they got a building permit and built in reliance on it. That's why I need some state law that deals with this problem.
Your Honor, I think that the Steuben County Waste Watchers case is the closest analogy in the case law, because in the cases where building permits have been issued, it was cases like the Shell Oil case out of Fort Wayne where the business applied for a building permit and an improvement location permit at the same time to build a new structure. That was not what happened in this, and that was also the Pinnacle Media case they cited on the billboards. They were building new structures, therefore disclosing the use and getting the improvement location permit along with the building permit was all the same thing. I mean, it was one cohesive process. And that's what it would have been if they had altered the change, or noted that they were changing the use of the property and applied for an improvement location permit. They would have had a vested right at that juncture. But the uncontroverted facts in the record show that they lied about what they were going to do. And even though they told in September or October of 2003 to Scott Wood, this is the Wood affidavit in the record at entry 19.
They lie about what they were going to do?
Your Honor, they represented that they were going to be...
If somebody builds a store at which they're planning to sell yogurt, do they have to tell you that it's going to be yogurt rather than Swiss cheese?
Your Honor, they don't have to... They could have applied for just any general retail, but that was a change in the use from the office structure that was used before. Within the zone, there are a lot of different permitted uses, including medical laboratories, professional offices, and banks. All of those have different site development standards, ingress and egress to and from the property, parking requirements. And therefore, it's incumbent upon the applicant to disclose at least the use so that those health and safety standards about ingress and egress and so forth can be met. In this case, they were told 2 months prior to their application for a building permit that they would have to do that, that they would have to disclose the use to the zoning office, file an ILP with the zoning office, an application, give a site plan and a parking plan. They intentionally did not want to do that. They thought they would be better off hiding their cards, saying they were going to do something else, and never filing anything at all with the zoning office until months after the ordinance took effect.
Am I correct in the way I have this in my own mind? The district court concluded that DVD was likely to succeed in establishing that it was a legally pre-existing business prior to adoption of the ordinance, and so allowed under, you know, the ordinance to continue operating for 2 years following the date of the ordinance. And the basis for the district court's holding was that DVD had demonstrated substantial compliance with the building and zoning regulations at the time that it was slated to open for business, and therefore the ordinance couldn't be applied retroactively to defeat the ILP. Are you with me so
that's
far?
That's what the court held.
Okay. Then the city, in its briefs, sets forth the Indiana law that rejects the notion of substantial compliance with zoning laws, and DVD doesn't, or I couldn't find it, doesn't even argue that substantial compliance is sufficient. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And instead, what DVD states is that it was issued in ILP in February of 2004, but provided no cite to the record, and that contradicted the city and the district court. And now you tell me, or you told us, that indeed there is no ILP, right?
You're absolutely correct, Judge Rovner.
Okay. Okay.
There is no February 19th permit of any kind. That was out of nowhere.
Okay. And what your bottom line argument is here, just so I have it straight, is that because the court erred in relying on DVD's substantial compliance, it shouldn't have found a likelihood of success on that claim.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I see that my time is up.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I think you hit the nail on the head. And the upshot is that they never applied for the ILP until months after. Had they done so, they might have had a vested right, but the district court erred as a matter of law in holding that Indiana would permit substantial compliance. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mason.
Good morning. My name is Steve Mason. I represent New Albany DVD. I want to start with this whole issue of an ILP, which is simply a form. First is the record or the
can't get married without one.
Well, you certainly need certain forms to do certain things, and I'm not discounting the fact that the form has some substantive importance, but not in this particular case. It's almost like we're running around the tree when we truly don't need to. What happened here is in December 2003, there's a typo in the order from Judge Barker, it's 2003, not 2004, we received an ILP and a business permit. Why do I say that?
Would you please use English? Stop with the acronyms.
Yes, sir. We received authorization from the government, the City of New Albany, to make all the changes to our business as required under state law and Indiana law. We received that in December of 2003. In reliance upon that, we spent $20,000 to $25,000 updating that building, and we were prepared to open on February 19th, 2004. When we went to court for the first of the two evidentiary hearings, they put on a witness from the City of New Albany. We had a form in our hand, and the form said you can open. It's an ILP, it's a building permit, whatever you want to call it, it's in the record. It was signed off by the City of New Albany. What occurred then was when they put their building commissioner on the stand, he said, I don't really know if it went across the street or the next door to zoning or not. But nonetheless, we gave you one, but we think we gave you the form in error. That's the issue. They think they gave us the form in error. So what happened then is Judge Barker recessed, took us into chambers, and says, look, I will rule upon this record based upon the form and the testimony, based upon Indiana law and federal law, or to use her exact language, you can clean up the underbrush and go back and fill out this form.
So is it your view that this whole ILP blah, 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 is nothing but some red herring here? Is that what you're...
Exactly. When the testimony was at the hearing, I even asked their representative, I said, is the question whether or not we comply with the form substantively?
Okay. Then should we instead be... zeroing in on... doesn't the district court in fact apply a least restrictive means test in that it complains that the city limited the location near dwellings but not occupied dwellings and limited the location near religious establishment rather than tracking the hours of operation for those establishment and doesn't that look like fine-tuning rather than a finding that the ordinance is substantially broader than necessary?
No, and I'll answer it with a multi-part answer. First is, it's obviously a preliminary injunction. 2 weeks ago, you held an oral argument called Annex Books from Indianapolis from Judge Barker. She granted the preliminary injunction, and at the end of the day, she denied the permanent injunction. The point is the judge should be given the latitude and the discretion, especially after two evidentiary hearings, to let her preliminary ruling stand until she ferrets out these complex constitutional questions. The Seventh Circuit has never addressed the issue of a pure retail establishment constituting a special class or subset of adult businesses which would apply some unique test. And you were on the panel for RVS, and you specifically said that unique businesses, and this is a paraphrase, and please pardon me, this is a paraphrase, but I've quoted it six, you know, I've highlighted it six times in RVS, and the Seventh Circuit says that if it's a unique type of business, a subclass, in that case a new creation, a bathing suit bar, then you're going to have unique evidence. And my point is this is a very important case. The Seventh Circuit may decide they agree with the Ninth Circuit and that a retail business, the sale of a magazine, is going to be treated no differently, or you may agree with the Fifth Circuit. All I'm trying to do is, as a beginning of my argument, is to convince you to at least put this case on hold and give her the benefit of the doubt.
Well, let me ask you this. If the city took the court's advice and restricted the hours of operation based on the hours of the religious establishments, I mean, couldn't that in fact result in a much greater restriction on protected speech and a kind of veto right by the religious groups? I mean, wouldn't that be the next case?
It might come down to the issue of whether or not it's fair play and it's done in good faith. But the uniqueness of this case in the context of narrow tailoring is on page 27 of their brief. They essentially argue, and this is my paraphrase, that Judge Barker essentially made this up. They state that we did not argue it, and it appeared for the first time in her paper, her order granting the preliminary injunction. But when you read the transcript from November of 2004, they flew in an expert from Santa Barbara at $300 an hour, and she questioned him extensively. And he says the fence should come down. Number two is it's not a question of whether or not it's a residential district. The harm is, in the concept of secondary effects, is whether or not does anyone live there. And number three is it's not the church per se. It's the church, whether or not the church is conducting business at a specific time. She then embraces the city's testimony, embraces their expert's testimony, and then they argue on appeal that she made that up and that you should reverse her and discount her analysis. So how can we chop up the facts of this case and dissect it from the law, the very unique complexities of this entire retail issue, and not give her the benefit of the doubt in terms of her discretion on a preliminary injunction? That's not fair. Number two is we can't discount or dissipate this case from this major issue percolating across the courts of this country as to whether retail establishments, pure retail establishments that sell sexually explicit materials, are going to in some way going to be treated differently than a go-go bar, an alcohol-serving establishment, a bookstore with live entertainment, et cetera. And my support for that, obviously, that's something I think the Seventh Circuit must be leaning in our direction, or it wouldn't have issued that proclamation in RVS. And for those reasons, you should not reverse her a narrow tailoring.
What proclamation are you thinking of?
RVS is a seminal case. It's been cited and discussed across the country. I'm from the 11th Circuit, and we cite it and we debate it there. It's obviously a very, very important case, and for that reason, it certainly dovetails or at least fits in with this argument.
You apparently are thinking of some particular thing. I'm asking you what it is.
It is that. Are all businesses that have the label of adult going to be treated identically for purposes of constitutional analysis in that four-part Renton or O'Brien test? Are they all going to be lumped together? And if I cite 10 studies that deal with adult alcohol-serving establishments, that means that in New Albany you can't sell a magazine that's sexually explicit because you're going to be treated identically? I mean, that doesn't pass a common sense.
I'm asking you for a citation to a place or something that was said, and you're not giving it to me. Is there something you have in mind that you want us to look at? If so, tell us what it is.
The only thing I'm referring to is 361 Fed 3rd 402 RVS, where this court repeatedly says the following. Most of Rockford's evidence, at least as presented to date, does not appear to be directly relevant to the type of entertainment that Rockford seeks to regulate. The court goes on, serious problem might render the offered evidence sufficient if the ordinance applied only to bars and clubs that present nude or semi-nude dancing. On the previous page, if Rockford had presented more convincing evidence to show that some businesses featuring clothed entertainment entertainers produce adverse secondary effects, a different result might ensue. The record is devoid of evidence connecting
I don't know where you think you're going. The case said it wasn't deciding that question, if I recall it, and it sounds like you're now reading parts where the case says we're not deciding that question. I don't see how the fact that some other case didn't decide a question helps you. Brown against Board of Education didn't decide this question either.
You declared the ordinance in Rockford unconstitutional because you determined that that was a unique, different type of entertainment that you had not historically analyzed in the context of the First Amendment. Judge Rovner was on that panel.
It doesn't make any difference who is on particular panels of this court. We
I
speak
understand.
For the institution.
Yes, sir. I understand. In terms of the issue of the form and whether we are entitled to operate, Indiana is a vested rights state. It's a snapshot in time. As of December 2003, when we applied for our license to operate, permit, whatever you want to call it, did the law at that point in time allow us to operate? It's not a hybrid state. I'll give you an example. In Florida, we're a hybrid vested rights state. You have to show detrimental reliance or bad faith on part of the government. Indiana is a pure vested rights state. When we submitted our application, whether we opened up or not, whether they gave us the license, whether they gave us this form, is completely irrelevant. If we were entitled to operate under the existing laws at that point in time...
What case do you rely on for the proposition that it's irrelevant whether you got an occupancy permit?
There's a case called Knutson. I cited it in the first sentence of that page. It said for almost 50 years, Indiana has been a pure vested rights state.
Yes, but what is the thing that causes the vesting?
At the time we submit our application for either zoning or building occupancy, at that moment in time,
right. So what case would you cite for the proposition that somebody who gets a building permit, builds, and then doesn't or can't get an occupancy permit because of a change in the zoning law, has a vested right under Indiana law?
Knutson, the age-old standby that started the doctrine, they embraced the doctrine, the Indiana Supreme Court.
Do you think Knutson involves that sequence?
No, I don't know if anything involves this sequence. I think my point is this, Judge. If we were a hybrid state, Coral Springs.
It doesn't help me to say that Indiana is a vested rights state unless you can show me what the event is that causes the rights to vest. And the difficulty I'm having is that both sides seem equally adamant that they know that their step is the critical one. You think it's the building permit.
I think it's the application.
You think it's the occupancy permit. I need some state case choosing between these documents.
Even
if you don't have one, it doesn't seem that either side has one. All we've got is hot air.
Even the cases they cite embrace the notion that the snapshot in time is when we ask to have the permit. Even if we don't get the permit, when we
permit?
The building permit or the entitlement to open and operate.
They're completely different documents.
Yes. But for purposes of vested rights, building or zoning is irrelevant. They're
and
both treated the same.
What case do you rely on for the proposition that there is no difference in Indiana law for this purpose?
All of the cases.
All
the cases I would contend stand for that broad proposition.
But they're the cases. I mean, look, the Supreme Court has left us with a real conundrum here. The cases are all over the map.
It's a hotly charged issue, and obviously, you know, people of reasonable mind sometimes differ. But this case, in this case, I'd ask that you affirm and uphold her preliminary finding. We have a long road ahead on both secondary effects, on retail issues, zoning issues below. I can't articulate it any better. I would just stand by the position that it's a pure vested rights state. It's a minority of states, as I recall. Most states aren't so liberal or embracing of the individual or company that wants to open and operate. Many states don't even acknowledge vested rights, and some states are a hybrid. When we submitted our application, there were no laws on the books that prevented us from operating. Even when Judge Barker sent us back and said, clean the underbrush, fill out the form for them and see if you comply, do it a second time, do it a third time, do it as many times you have, and they came back and said, yes, you can open and operate at that location in New Albany. There's nothing that prevents you from operating other than our new law that we want to retroactively apply against you. She saw that. And when she uses the word substantial, I don't think she uses the word substantial in the context of the law. She uses the word substantial in the context of look how much work we did in reliance upon the license and permit that we received from the city. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Mason.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Burkle?
Yes, sir.
The permit that they were granted, whatever we call it, is in the record at Entry 19, Exhibit E. The text of that permit is that they did not apply for a change in use or they did not disclose. As far as the city knew, they were rehabbing the interior of a building. For what purpose, they did not disclose. It says, the form itself says, I agree to observe and conform to all use governing all laws in the city of New Albany and ordinances governing the use of land. And then it says, subject to the conditions stated above, there's an applicant is granted a permit to do this, to remodel the commercial interior, and that if you don't comply with all the zoning ordinances, it's immediately null and void. The fact that some kind of retail use might have been permitted in a particular district, it does not grandfather them for an application which involved a change of use and an improvement location permit months later, months after the ordinance took effect. It is true that Indiana is a pure vested rights doctrine, but the fairness cuts both ways. It's strict on both ends. If you follow all the rules and you submit your timely application, you are vested as of the date that you submit it for the specific project for which you're submitting it. However, if you do not do that, it cuts the other way, that you will not be protected against future ordinances that take the place, especially when if there's a close call, fairness comes into play, and the undisputed record evidence is that they knew about this requirement.
Are you just going to send me, if I ask you for authority, back to Steuben Weight Watchers?
Your Honor, I think the Steuben Weight Watchers case is helpful, although this specific factual sequence is not necessarily on point. The Weight Watchers case is helpful because
look,
it says...
You're making a proposition about Indiana law. The proposition is that if you get a building permit and your proposed use is completely consistent with the building code, and you build out under the building permit, you nonetheless, under Indiana law, have no vested rights if you did not disclose in your application for the building permit precisely what use would be made of the renovated property. Now, if there's some state case that cites that, then you're on firm ground. Is there? What is the case, state case, that supports that?
Your Honor, I think a fair reading and application of the Steuben County case does support it because it says a new ILP, although people had previous permits for landfill construction.
Would you please stop the acronyms? New what?
A new improvement location permit did not protect them against the future zoning ordinance. The district court found they had not applied for this type of permit, but nevertheless legally erred in saying that they substantially complied. I see that my time is up, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.